Welcome to Parents' Perspective. By the time we packed to return home from the trip, it was clear that our daughter was terribly ill. Her obsession with mealtimes had become obvious. She was unable to speak rationally about anything involving food or her body. The dizziness was now constant, and she confessed to once blacking out. She became angry when confronted with food, nervous when mealtimes approached, and physically ill and frightened after consuming anything. On the 10-hour drive home, Samuel and I stared at the road ahead of us as though we were falling back to our house rather than driving. Beside her, Olympia had a 2-inch stack of cooking magazines. She read each one carefully during the entire drive. She fed her brother from the cooler full of snacks packed for the ride, but she did not eat. Aside from Elijah's calls for more snacks between video games, the only sound in that car was magazine pages being turned. The day we returned, I scheduled an appointment between the pediatrician and me. I said I believed Olympia was anorexic. I laid out the symptoms, the irrational behaviors and thoughts. Then I brought my daughter under protest to the office. This time I was sure I would get the solid backup we needed to convey the seriousness of the situation to this recalcitrant child.
"You should probably eat more, but you're still doing all right,"
the doctor said. Olympia actually smiled. That conversation still astonishes me. The front-line primary care foot soldier had, in one sentence, brushed away my daughter's trust in my judgment and my trust in the doctor's office. My daughter heard she was all right, and I heard you were on your own. I have since heard this identical story from other parents. Even doctors don't understand eating disorders. When we did confess, only to those who absolutely had to know, that it was anorexia, we discovered that this well-known disease is everything but. And unlike other diseases that need attention in order to raise funds, anorexia needs to be known for another reason entirely. In this case, ignorance kills. Our ignorance could have killed our daughter. This is part of the story of author Laura Collins and her family, as told in Eating with Your Anorexic, How My Child Recovered Through Family-Based Treatment, and Yours Can Too. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about this disease and about the family-based treatment Laura Collins and her husband used to rescue their daughter? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest became an expert in this area through her own family's experience. Laura Collins is a freelance writer and editor in Northern Virginia whose work has appeared in a number of magazines. She and her husband are the parents of a 17-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Laura.
It's delightful to be here.
What have you found to be the biggest myth about anorexic young people?
The biggest myth is definitely that they've chosen the illness. I think we try to use eating disorders as a metaphor, but really it's a mental illness, and people don't choose to be schizophrenic, they don't choose to be bipolar, they don't choose to be anorexic. This is not what we're told as parents by many professionals out there because they were trained in an earlier era, but it's fairly well established now that this is not something that someone chooses. It's not a control issue. It's not someone deciding to take control over their life by the way they eat, any more than depression is a choice that someone makes or schizophrenia is a choice.
So this is something that could run in a family?
It is 50 to 80% heritable.
Some families, you have multiple children with the same problem?
Yes. Identical twins are far more likely to share it. Parents with eating disorders often have eating disordered children. It's not a brown eye, green eye thing. And it's not a, if the parent has it, then the child will have it. But you generally will see in a family, you have a much higher likelihood of having it. And if you look at a couple of generations, you'll generally find one. We don't in our family, as far as I know. But similar to schizophrenia, we're still in early stages of understanding. But twin studies and other genetic testing have established that there is a heritable basis here. And that knowledge can be very powerful for parents in that, one, it might help them understand their own eating issues in a better context. It also removes the guilt, because if you feel as if this is something that your child was prone to instead of something that you've done or not done to have it happen, then your in a good position to be able to help them better.
When you say a child is prone to, does that mean that it can kick in through circumstances? Is that why we see it in adolescence?
This is an excellent question, and it's one that we haven't answered for bipolar, but there is obviously a relationship because bipolar shows up often in adolescent years. Schizophrenia, there's a time range in which it starts. The problem with eating disorders is that we have for so long looked at it as a choice or as extreme dieting that it's hard for us to shift our paradigm to understand it as a real illness. And I think for parents, it's necessary that we do that because it helps us empower ourselves to take control of a situation. We're often told, don't be the food police. This isn't something you should be doing. This is a legacy of an era in which parents were believed to cause eating disorders. So I am trying to get the word out to parents that newer knowledge about the brain and about mental illness gives us back permission to have a role in helping our children with their eating disorder. But the memo hasn't gotten out to everyone yet. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of practitioners, I'd say most practitioners in the United States, are telling parents to back off.
Mm. Now, I'm thinking about the heritability of it and how things run in families. And I'm thinking this kind of thing in whatever we consider the olden days, didn't seem to be as much around. Is this something that was around and nobody talked about it and people would just waste away? Or is it something that is just a factor of our modern civilization for whatever reason?
That's really the question, and there are two things happening. One is we have better data now and we have treatment, so people are diagnosed. We have a category for this. What used to be our aunt who always fed people but never ate, what used to be the grandmother who, you know, around mealtimes grew very nervous, we may have been seeing something that was an eating disorder. So now we diagnose it. We have psychologists and psychiatrists and treatment places where you can go. So we have a category. It looks like the numbers are growing. The other thing is that we have a lot of dieting going on. And there's a lot of evidence that dieting itself can trigger an eating disorder with someone who has the genetics for it. So if my daughter, for example, had never restricted her diet, if my daughter had never suffered from malnutrition, which she did when she started a rather extreme diet, the eating disorder may never have gone off if she had never done that. But chances are throughout her life, at some point, she would probably go under the amount of food that she would need. Under the amount of nutrients, not just calories, but nutrients. And it might have set off the anorexia. That's what I believe. I'm actually happy that my daughter became anorexic at 14 when she was still in my home and when we could still have some ability to research it, help her, and teach her how to deal with the illness. If this had happened, as it does for many people when they first go to college, the parents are already somewhat alienated. They're being told to back off for a lot of things. And so the eating disorder just seems to be part of a larger issue of individuation. But really, like depression, and I hate to keep bringing that one up, but our better understanding of mental illnesses helps me understand my daughter's illness better. And I'm just really excited about the future of treatment.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on family-based treatment for anorexia.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Laura Collins about family-based treatment for anorexia. What do you see as the biggest challenge for families when a child is anorexic?
Absolutely, the biggest challenge is getting good care. Because as parents, we don't know how to find psychiatric or psychological care. We know how to find a pediatrician. We know how to take a temperature. We do not know anything about eating disorders. It's just not part of our education. So finding care and then discerning what care is going to work for our particular family. Most of us have health plans that only allow us to go to one or two. Eating disorder specialists are actually quite rare. And then there's just the issue of money and time. It's not something we've usually fit into our life. We may not even recognize it as a mental health problem. We may think it's a behavioral issue, or our child is simply acting like we did when we were teenagers. But really, eating disorders are something very different and need to be taken extremely seriously from the earliest sign that there's an eating disorder.
And what are the early signs and signals?
Different for different kids. So although you can find lists of different symptoms, I feel that parents should really listen to their gut on this one. I've never talked to a parent whose kid had an eating disorder who didn't feel it pretty early on. They may have been told by other people that it wasn't an issue. They may have been given signals from coaches or pediatricians, it's not such a big deal. But all of us feel it pretty early. There is something wrong. Your gut tells you. We're parents, we love our kids, and you can feel that something has just slipped out of place. In my daughter's case, it happened very quickly, over a two-week period. Very big changes in her behaviors and in her thoughts. We're fairly close, so she was verbalizing them. If we hadn't been close, or if we'd been living a lifestyle in which I didn't see much of her, I think it would have been very easy for me not to notice until she was pretty critically ill. And that's what happens to most parents, because at the age 13, 14, 15, when these things start cropping up, the parents are also spending less time with their children. And then the child learns to cover up these issues because the anxiety of having an eating disorder is very high. And the impulse to hide your behaviors because it's causing your mother anxiety, or because people at school are talking, or any of these things that are making you anxious will also cause you to try to conceal them and hide them, because the disease starts to seem like your friend, not your enemy. It's a very counterintuitive sort of illness. So it's hard to predict who will get an eating disorder and what the earliest signs are.
What did you notice first?
I noticed my daughter becoming very anxious around mealtimes, saying strange, exaggerated things about food. Most women my age have been on some kind of crazy, wacky diet at some point. But the way she spoke about food started to sound really unnatural. Because my family is fairly normal, it did really stick out very quickly. In a family where there's a lot of putting down your body, body image issues, food issues, it probably won't seem as obvious as early.
What kinds of things did she say that got you suspicious?
She would talk about how she'd eaten too much when I knew that certainly she was eating less than usual. She would exercise in a very nervous-driven fashion instead of in a joyful, happy way. But she was an athlete. I thought this is what athletes do. She finally one day, and this was the moment at which I understood that my daughter had an eating disorder, she came to me and she said, "Mom, I ate an apple." And she looked very scared. And I said, "Honey, you just ate an apple. Why are you annoying me with this?" And she said, "I ate the whole apple, and I can see it coming out on my arms." She had the physical sensation that she was growing when she ate. This is something that people with eating disorder thoughts truly have: somatic symptoms of feeling larger than they are, of food changing them immediately, not over a few days, but immediately. These are real sensations, and I think we have to take it very seriously and not laugh at it and not put them down or try to talk them out of it, but see it as a symptom of a real illness that is treatable, but it's scary.
Now, in terms of the treatment of the illness, can you explain how your treatment, the family-based treatment, is different than the stuff that we all assume we know about?
This is really important. My family operated under the assumption that my daughter was being controlled by her illness and that it's neurobiological. That's very different than the idea that my daughter was trying to control her environment through food. We felt that the disease was coming from within her and causing her to control her food. That became a vicious cycle. The less she ate, the sicker she got. Her brain stopped working correctly, and this got worse and worse the less she ate. What she was suffering was malnutrition. There was a study in World War II where a group of conscientious objectors, young men, volunteered to eat a starvation diet to study the effects of starvation. This was a contained environment of young men. They ate about 1,200 calories, if I remember correctly, a day. They became extremely strange. They started obsessing about food. They began collecting recipes. They began going into trash cans and trying to look for food. They ran away. One of them became so disordered in his mind that he cut off one of his hands. These are the effects of starvation. Most of what I saw with my daughter was the effect of starvation. And the way to turn that around is food. All eating disorder treatment involves food, but a lot of eating disorder treatment makes it voluntary and tries to talk the person into doing it. I don't consider that ethical with what I know about eating disorders. My daughter could not choose to eat. That was not an option available in her own mind. Had I put her in a treatment center and in hospital, she would have been compelled to eat. So in our home, she was compelled to eat. And by this, I don't mean that I force-fed her. My husband and I simply withdrew all support for anything else. In other words, we sat down to eat a full meal, all of the calories and nutrients that my daughter needed. And it wasn't an option. Just like if we sat down and she had to have chemotherapy, we were not going to negotiate on the amounts, but we would comfort her and love her and support her through the painful process of eating it regardless, because we understood it was very, very hard.
She never got up and just left the table?
Yes, she did. But we stayed there, and we made it clear that the rest of life was not going to go on for us or for her unless that meal was taken. And surprise, surprise, just as in a hospital when they require them to eat, my daughter ate. And I find it incredible in this day and age that we do not offer this option first to parents, but it simply isn't offered to most parents.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on family-based treatment for anorexia.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Laura Collins, author of Eating With Your Anorexic, about family-based treatment for anorexia.
So now the dynamics of how you did it. So she would sit down with you at the table, say, I'm not doing this, go up to her room and do her homework or go to sleep or whatever she did. And then how would you enforce this thing so that she would have to come back and sit down?
There was no homework. There was no room. There was no TV. There was no phone. There was no nothing unless she ate.
How could you keep her from going to her room?
We would go up and lovingly, just as I would if she had to come downstairs and take a shot for chemotherapy. If she didn't want to go to the doctor and take a shot, it's my job as parent to do that. Not in a punitive or in a coercive or angry way, but in a very sympathetic and loving way. I understood. I could see. I know my daughter, how painful it was for her. Every single meal, every single bite was very, very hard. But my job was to make sure that happened anyway. And I wasn't doing anything different than what they do in the hospital, which is they sit them down and they say, you will finish this in a half an hour. And if you don't, we're going to give you a nutritional supplement in a drink. And if you don't drink that, we're going to put you on a nasogastric tube. If that's not coercive, I don't know what is. And in that context, she wouldn't have had her loving family around her. And she also wouldn't have had therapy to tell her why she was ill. And I think that's also important to our story, is that my daughter was not given artificial and, in my opinion, incorrect ideas about why she had her illness. So she didn't go to a treatment center and then come back and tell us why she was ill based on what some psychiatrist or psychologist said, based on very little knowledge of my daughter.
But you were getting her to go for some therapy?
We could not find a therapist to work with us. We do not live in an area of the country where this treatment was offered at that time. It is now. This treatment is now offered at Stanford, at the University of Chicago, Duke, Columbia, and several other well-regarded treatment centers, most of them nonprofit and associated with educational institutions. This treatment is expanding as people are coming to understand that it is evidence-based, that it has been working successfully for 20 years in the UK, where eating disorder patients are rarely hospitalized. What I want is for American parents to have this choice. And the only way to do that is to get the word out, for parents to ask for it and to keep asking until they are offered the choice. I'm not saying that all parents should do it this way. I'm not saying all parents can do it this way. We were very lucky in a lot of ways. But I do feel that every loving family should be offered this choice and support while they're doing it.
What was the aspect of this journey that you would redo differently if you had the chance?
I would get more support from the people around me. Mm-hmm. I would, and I now advise parents, get your pastor involved. If your child had cancer, people would be bringing you casseroles, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't feel guilty for asking for help with rides, with babysitting, with moral and emotional support, with respite time. We deserve that. It's very hard to care for an eating disordered person at home. It's worth it, but it's really hard. I would have gotten more support, but I felt very alone and beleaguered. And I tell parents now, you deserve the help. Go out and ask, just as you would give it to someone else. You deserve it.
Laura, before we have to close, is there anything that we should know that we haven't thought to ask you yet?
Two quick things. And one is that the role of my husband in this is sometimes downplayed because I wrote the book. But my husband has been my full partner in this. And this isn't because he and I agreed at every stage, but because we put the priority on my daughter's health and our family's health. And I'm very, very grateful to my husband for his support in letting me tell this story through this book. And most important is my daughter had a very hard job in getting herself better. There were times when she needed us to push her. There was times when we needed to pull her. But she's really had to do the hard work of getting better, and she really deserves the credit for getting well.
What about siblings in this mix? Now, you had a younger son, but obviously there's people who are listening to this have siblings of all different ages and stages. What would you advise parents about the siblings?
The Maudsley method, which is what we're talking about, family-based, home-based refeeding and treatment, very much involves the siblings. Instead of treating this as a problem of one child, it sees the disease as affecting everyone in the family, and that everyone has a role in supporting the ill sibling and also getting their needs met. And I think that's a really beautiful aspect of this is healing the effects of this disease on an entire family. Not that the family caused it, but we can all pull together, and the siblings have a wonderful, wonderful role to play.
In addition to your book, Eating with Your Anorexic, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want or feel they need to pursue this topic more thoroughly?
After I wrote the book, I started a website which lists resources for parents, research that backs this idea up, and also talks about the physiology of eating disorders. It's at eatingwithyouranorexic.com. There's also a free and anonymous parents forum in real time online that parents can read. I think we have over 1,500 messages from parents talking about their journey, how they are refeeding, recipes, ideas, support, and their fine group of parents.
Now, is that all on this site?
It's all on the site.
We are so fortunate to have been able to have Laura Collins discuss her new book, Eating with Your Anorexic, How My Child Recovered Through Family-Based Treatment and Yours Can Too. This has been an extraordinary interview, and we know listeners all over will benefit from it. So thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Laura Collins' book, Eating with Your Anorexic, How My Child Recovered Through Family-Based Treatment and Yours Can Too. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 281 and tell us, if you can, what station you are listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you are tuning into.
To learn more about Parents Perspective, please visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. You can listen to Parents Perspective via podcast anytime. Just go to the website, click Listen to Podcast, and follow the instructions. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. We want to give you some resources on runaways today. These are resources we frequently offer as reminders for families. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-843-5678. And you ask for family advocacy. And the National Runaway Switchboard, 1-800-621-4000. 1-800-621-4000. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.